Hey everybody, we're back with another commission podcast. This time it's another Australian movie. We've got another good one here in the hopper. Is a hopper a word that they use in Australia?
It's a film on the Barbie, I think.
The hopper? That's more New England than
I don't even know
Australian.
What the hell, what you're doing.
I don't either, man.
I try to do a New England accent, it devolves into an Aussie accent and vice versa.
Yeah, yeah. They're
it's the
they're
law
fairly
of intransitive
similar.
Accents.
So who commissioned this? Tell us a little about it.
This would be Tim, a.k.a. Double T from our forums at forums.baldmove.com. He also commissioned Animal Kingdom.
Yeah, yeah. So the proposition is kind of another movie along those lines,
and what caused it is that he heard our podcast for the Kate Winslet. Holy Smokes.
Holy Smokes,
and you said, I guess I've now seen the two best Australian films. And he's like, bullshit, this aggression cannot stand. So he decided to, and his personal, he felt like that this, okay, I'll just read his comments. He says, after you, I had you do the cast for Animal Kingdom, I felt like this film was also a must. These two are close to the best Aussie films of this past decade, and they're definitely my two favorites. They also share similarities so much that I consider them companion films. The only actual common link, as far as I know, is Guy Pearce. However, they're both about crime families, and each story focuses on three brothers and other gang members. Both feature one evil, unhinged brother, with the others being a bit more sympathetic. So let's stop here and say, what did you think of this as being a companion piece to Animal Kingdom? Because I felt two movies that were in the back of my mind the entire time I was watching this. One was the Animal Kingdom.
Uh-huh.
Because we felt, you know, there's another one where you're kind of thrown into the middle of this dynamic. You don't know who the bad guys are. And I felt also like, I felt like I was missing a lot of cultural significance here.
Sure.
You know, like this is set in Aussie outback during the kind of like, you know, Australia being civilized, I guess, transitioning from its penal colony phase into the first world country it is today. And there's conflicts with the Aborigines and conflicts with these outlaws out, you know, hiding in the Badlands.
Mm-hmm.
And I kept thinking this reminded me of Animal Kingdom because we were looking for this brother.
Yeah.
Who's the bad one who everyone's looking for. And every time I met someone new, I'm like, is this the brother? Is this the brother? Is this... Finally, it's like, okay, yes, this is the brother. But I felt a lot like that, and I also felt a lot like the 310 to Yuma is
sure.
The other one.
Those were both going through my head, too.
And
it's very different, though. This is nothing like 310 to Yuma, in my opinion.
It's much... So they're both Westerns. They're both in the Western archetype, but setting it in Australia somehow... You know, you read these reviews and everyone talks about the oppressive, bleak landscape. And I thought, like, you know, you can't beat the American Southwest. They're all desert. How much worse can it get? But, I mean, this Australian place is a hellscape.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. That 310 to Yuma feels like a movie to me. This feels almost like...
A film?
Yeah, there's something different about it, right? Like, it's harsher, maybe deals with real issues a little bit more.
It's much more artistic too.
And what I mean
is like it's kind of it feels
it's not as glossy.
310 to Yuma, you could go to and see it at a Cineplex
and maybe have some popcorn with it, right?
The proposition is like you go to an art house theater and you see the film. But I'm not. I feel like that's.
There are no like shootouts in the street. There's no high noon
but there
showdown.
There are lots of violence.
There's a lot of violence, but it's not like shootout style violence.
The movie opens with this climactic violence, and then it kind of just settles into this character story about character study.
Whereas 310 to Yuma climaxes with a brilliant shootout, right?
Yeah.
And this never felt like, you know, anybody was going to duel in the streets or anything. It was more like a sneak up on you and blow you away while you're not looking sort of film.
Yeah.
And that to me has a very different vibe to it, right? It's less about heroes and more about kind of morality of everyone in this scenario.
Right. But it's kind of one of those things where I feel like I was wondering, like, what would a international person who would see, like, a movie about Custard's Last Stand.
Okay.
And also, like, which Custard's Last Stand would they get? Would they get, like, the one that glorifies their last stand against the Indians? Would it be the one where it's, like, more of a historical revision where it's like, well, actually, maybe the army are the assholes and the Indians are the noble characters that are the freedom fighters. And then it's sure. like, I felt like we saw this latter thing. Like, maybe this is something that's mythologized in Australian lore, and, mm-hmm. and now it's something they're kind of looking back and examining. But I didn't have any of that, you know, that relationship with how Australia struggled with the indigenous people and what it was like to tame the West. And now I'm getting, like, the refutation of this, like, taming the West, and I didn't get the glorification of it. So now it's just like, wow, this is really bleak, and I wasn't sure how to feel about it. Like, for example, Stanley, the Captain Stanley, Sam Winston.
A lot of spoilers coming up, so
yeah,
if like you're you not into see, yeah, spoilers, like, go away.
And I don't know how to explain this movie except for to say you've seen it, because it feels like a Western made by aliens to me.
Okay. All right. You know, like it's a Western from an alien land.
A lot of
certainly.
The archetypes are there, and a lot of the characters are there, and a lot of the settings and situations, but everything has a very different feel and sensibility to it.
Yes.
So it's definitely stretches the boundaries of what now I consider a Western. Mm-hmm. And the same way I thought 310 to Yuma did the same thing. But, and here's the thing. Like, so Captain Stanley, I wasn't sure if he was a heroic figure or not, because when he first shows in, he's screaming about civilization and he's got these, you know, Aborigines stooges that are like kind of race traders, I guess. And his men are all drunk and maybe rapists, and they're abusing, they're rounding up these Aborigines and killing them and torturing them and doing all this stuff. It's like, is this guy a bad guy? And I thought, like, this is the bad guy. Mm-hmm. But then the outlaws that he's hunting burned people alive and raped his family, and, you know, his wife that was like a personal friend of theirs or one of the victims of that tragedy. And then you meet Guy Pearce and his brother, and like, these guys seem like the good guys. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, I just never felt like throughout the whole movie until the very end, when like I was relieved when Guy Pearce came to regulate, mm-hmm. that I wasn't going to see a rape and a double murder. Then I'm like, I guess he's the good guy.
Yeah, and it's tough to even say that Stanley is a good or a bad guy, even by the end of the movie, right? Like, there's a lot of stuff that he refuses to put up with, morality-wise.
Sure.
Like, he can't possibly fathom the idea that, you know, he's going to make a deal with Charlie Bunz, and then he's not going to come through on his end when Charlie shows up. He's like, don't whip this kid to death. Mm-hmm. But yet, at the beginning of the movie and throughout the movie, he's kind of like hunting these Aboriginal people. Mm-hmm. So like, he clearly doesn't have a moral hang up about that. And it muddies the water as to, you know, the morality of his character. But compared to everyone else, he's clearly got more of a conscience, right?
It seems a bit, he's also smarter. It's kind of pragmatic, because it's like, I don't think he had a problem whipping, like, at one point, the mayor of the town, I guess, or maybe the provincial governor, I couldn't figure out. He's played by Faramir from The Lord of the Rings. He's Boromir's brother, is where you'll know him from. Or if you watch Top of the Lake, he was the creepy police lieutenant that had an improper relationship with Peggy from Mad Men, amongst other people.
Is it made clear what relationship they have? Like, who is this guy?
I don't know, because, he's some important... I felt he's at least the mayor of the border town. I think he might have been maybe the provincial governor.
But he says at one point, like, this is... do the job I brought you here to do, Stanley,
So Stanley, he's a cop, but he's also kind of like, I guess, the U.S. cavalry is what it feels like. He's kind of like a general... Custard figure.
Okay.
Not custard.
Yeah.
Custard figure. Mm-hmm. So he shows up and he's like this, you know, kind of a simpering little fart, but he's like really hardcore, and he orders this guy after he was, you know, the proposition, we should lay this out. The proposition, Captain Stanley captures Guy Pearce.
And his brother and Mikey.
His brother Mikey. These are the Burns brothers.
The Bunz brothers.
Or as Jim liked to call them, the Bunz brothers.
Charlie Bunz.
And says, look, you go out and find your brother, who we know is the ringleader. He's the reason you guys are all a bunch of rapists, thugs, and murderers.
Yeah, we need to talk about this in context of the proposition itself.
Because I'm taking this as also a historical event. Like, there was this outrage where this, like I said, I feel like this is a real life historical event. There's this outrage where they beset this, you know, settlers, and they burnt their house and maybe burned some of them alive, and there's raping of women and killing of children. But the thing is when we finally meet this guy, he seems kind of literate and artsy and maybe like a guy, like a
warrior poet sort of deal.
Yeah, like a freedom fighter.
Okay.
You know, like a Fidel Castro type.
But even that is kind of turned on its head at some point.
But, I mean, well, at the beginning of the movie tells us who he is, and we meet him, and he seems like he defies the... And that he reminds me a lot of the character of Russell Crowe played in 310 to Yuma.
Okay, sure.
You know, but the thing is, they spent a lot of the movie telling me why Russell Crowe is the guy who is and what the guy he wished he was... And made that kind of, by the end, it played off beautifully when he switched sides and decided to, you know, stand up for the moral, courageous person. You know, he essentially sacrificed himself to save his image, the good guy's image. And this, it's like this guy, he was literary and kind of kind and gentle and insightful, but he's also this murderous person, and there was no context for those actions. So it was very hard for me to understand him. And very hard for me to understand why Guy Pearce didn't just show up and kill him, which would have made the movie very short and would have saved a lot of drama at the end.
Well, it's his brother, right? So, I mean, there's the familial bond.
But there didn't seem to be. Like,
well, there is. There's certainly a hesitation in Charlie to kill his brother that's shown. I mean, like you said, he doesn't just show up and murder him and be done with it. So clearly there's something in Charlie that says, I don't want to kill Arthur. There's like he doesn't want to do that until... Arthur takes it too far, right? He's like,
but
he's once again shown his ass to the world and to Charlie. And
that's what I'm saying. But knowing Charlie as I did in the film, I feel like taking it too far could have referred to the original atrocity that happened before the film. So it's like he should have been ready to be like, well, I'm going to save my innocent brother. Oh, by the way, Mikey didn't seem like a criminal at all. In fact, I feel like maybe something was wrong with him.
Yeah. So let's talk about the proposition in that context, because I personally think the proposition that he delivers, that he makes with Charlie, is smart. I think it's a good thing to do. You know, okay, so the scenario that he's presented with is Charlie and Mikey have separated from Arthur, right? They're not up
have
in the
they?
Mountains. Well, they're not up in the mountains.
I thought
living
they just
with...
got captured in some unrelated shootout where they were in town for some reason. I didn't know that they'd actually ran away.
The impression I got, was that... I mean, otherwise, why wouldn't Arthur also be there? Like, I got the impression
also,
that they were
separating. It
took
me a while to master
from...
the accents. Like, I felt like, know when you watch, what's the movie that did this? It's Hunt for Red October, where everyone's speaking Russian, and then there's this one, and it's subtitled, and there's one scene where it kind of, like, zooms in on Sean Connery's mouth, and then he starts speaking English, and it zooms out, and that's the way the movie's saying, like, okay, we're going to stop
this Russian
shit now, because we've exhausted Sean Connery's willingness to talk Russian.
Sure.
I felt like that happened with the Australian accents. Like, 15 minutes in, the film kind of got fuzzy, and then, like, oh, I was able to hear them. Uh-huh. But a lot of the setup, I was like, what, the Buns brothers? And they're... what is this?
It also didn't help that the center track of my television just basically doesn't come through.
Yeah.
And so all the audio is muffled compared to...
But
gunshots
they also
and
were,
footsteps.
They also talk kind of like, you know, there's a lot of breathy mumbles.
Yeah,
because it's also not fair to say. I don't think this was. I feel like the Australian accent really was non-existent here. It felt more British.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these guys are, you know, colonial settlers, right? These are the people coming over doing the dirty work.
Yeah.
In fact, it makes a lot of sense.
The captain and his wife, they actually are from England, right?
Yes.
Like, they're from Europe. They're wanting their damn green garden with the roses in it, and she's...
And the Buns brothers are Irish, I guess.
Burns is a Scottish surname, and there's this song that they're singing, this, like, haunting, is like Ode to Happier Times or something like that. I forget the exact...
So, Charlie gets awfully offended at the... insult, like John Hurt's insulting of the Irish, if he's not in fact Irish, unless he's playing it up for that scene where he gives the name Murphy.
But that's the thing, he was trying to evade the bounty hunter that was looking for his brother, so he would, wouldn't he? Like, he would, it's in it, behoove him. But the reason I say also that ode to Happier Days is also a Scottish hymn.
Yeah.
And Burns is a Scottish surname.
But they're using Irish accents even when they talk with each other. Yes. Arthur and Charlie are both using Irish accents when they're looking at the sunset talking. Like,
so this is a good time to say that Arthur is played by Jack Huston.
Huston?
No, because he's related to Angela Huston.
And Angelica?
Angelica Huston. Huston? Sorry. Okay. And Jack Huston, who played... who's the guy with the tin face on Boardwalk Empire? Richard Harrow,
yeah.
Is, I think, his nephew. So there's this Huston dynasty, and the place I've seen him most recently was in the last two seasons of American Horror Story.
He's spelling his name wrong.
Well, it's a Scottish surname, so
fair enough.
That's what the town in Texas is named after. Uh-huh. It was settled by Scottish people in the 17th century. It's a fact. You can look it up.
Sure,
it's on Wikipedia. Let me edit that article real quick. All right. I feel like he does look like this philosopher murderer.
Yeah.
He kind of plays that role in American Horror.
Oh, okay.
A lot, where he's always like this genteel. Maybe he's a scientist, but he's also a Nazi war criminal, or he's a jazz player, but he's also an axe murderer. He plays that duality, like maybe he got typecast a bit in this, but...
Yeah, maybe so.
The thing is he's just such a bit part, and I got no read to him. And then at the end, like...
Yeah, can we...
They have this Walter White, Mike the Mantrout situation, where Guy Pearce fatally wounds him. Mm-hmm. Because he's tired of his raping and pillaging, and he goes out into the sunset, gut shots him, goes out in the sunset to die, and Guy Pearce sits down beside him to have this like last moment with his brother.
Yeah,
and that I will say that his brother also just doesn't seem to ever see that coming. The fact that his brother could betray him.
Yeah, and I guess that's why like this. After seeing this movie, I'm thinking, well, okay, so the reason he didn't kill his brother is because it's his brother. Like, they have these moments where they sit down and they talk and they kind of understand each other to a certain degree, but eventually it just becomes too much for Charlie, right? And his other brother, who I think he likes better, is at stake here. So up until, you know, he's killed and they find out that he's killed. So I don't know. You also might say that maybe Charlie in this scenario kind of blames Arthur for getting his brother killed. Like, we wouldn't be in this situation if it wasn't for you.
No, I think that's totally right, because none of these brothers, and now, except for the one crazy one who is still with the Huston character. What is his name? You just said his name was?
Arthur.
Arthur.
Arthur
except
Buns.
For the, so who was that? Wasn't actually a Buns brother.
Oh.
The guy at the end.
So it's weird. The synopsis on this for IMDb says four Burns brothers.
So he could be another Burns brother.
But we never get his name as far as I can tell.
If that's the case, those two seem like they're the bad seed of the family.
Yeah.
Which I guess that's another Animal Kingdom
thing. Danny being the...
Except for one of those guys that we thought were brothers wasn't actually a brother, and I wonder if that's also the case for this guy. Except for...
Could be.
He was the decent guy, the one to get out of and start getting his stocks investing, and this other non-brother floater on was actually as bad as the worst of the brothers.
And so that's why I say it's kind of a smart plan, right? If Stanley looks at this scenario and he's like, okay, so they've separated from Arthur and the other potential Buns brother, I can see where his loyalties lie. More so than to Arthur, they lie with Mikey, right? So now I've got Mikey, and I'm going to coerce him into doing this thing for me, to finding Arthur, and he probably knows where he is or where he was last.
Yeah, or at least familiar with the territory to where he can do a better job attracting than my guys could.
And he's going to be able to integrate himself into Arthur's group again, right? Mm-hmm. Like pretty easily, way more easily than Stanley could have. So that idea, like, combine that with the loyalty and the ease of integration and finding him, and I think it's a good plan. And everybody else seems to be completely blind to that idea. They just are looking to capture these guys at all costs.
Yeah, like, why aren't you out there finding them?
Well, he is. He's letting somebody else do the legwork, right? Like, that's the thing that they don't understand.
Yeah. Well, and it's...
So a lot of my sympathy lies with Stanley.
Agreed.
In this, Stanley and Charlie, I think, are obviously the two most sympathetic characters.
Agreed. What did you make of the scene where Stanley and his wife's manservant, who was one of the Aboriginal peoples, he just took off? And at first I thought that Stanley was dismissing him, but then when I started thinking about the scene, I actually think the guy just was like, he had heard about, you know, what was coming their way, and he didn't want any part of it. He didn't want to be the guy sitting here around the home when the thundercloud found this family.
Okay.
And he took off, and but he left his shoes behind.
I thought that was a statement of protest. Like, fuck you. You're part of the system, man.
Really? I'm out.
These shoes, I don't need your fucking shoes. I'm going back to the desert.
Huh. That's the other thing is I didn't really get culturally what was going on a lot because there was this one, you know, character who was an Aborigine who was serving with the people that were hunting, and they had two things. Uh-huh. They seem like they are destroying belligerent Aboriginals, which I will say that their spears are shockingly effective.
Yeah.
Like, there are some horrific scenes of people just embedded with these things like pincushions, and we see Guy Pearce take a vicious one that it's hard to believe he would live through.
It's almost in the heart.
Because I was trying to argue. It's like, well, it's high up in his shoulder that maybe it just missed his lung lobe and it maybe went clean through. But later in the movie, we see the exit wound. And it fucking bisected
his
body, man. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And it goes through him like a hot knife through butter.
Mm-hmm.
Like I
can imagine,
it's
like
shocking devastation.
Put a 15-pound pole behind a sharp enough point and heave it with all you've got, and I bet it does that.
It didn't stop till it hit the ground. It was crazy. But he's got two jobs, like to brutalize the tribal people and bring them in the order, and also to brutalize and kill the outlaws out there.
Yeah, which is why he's such a morally muddy character.
But it's weird because the Aborigine that was helping them, and I hope I'm not using super offensive terms, because like maybe Aborigine is a huge slur now and there's a different word for them, but...
Well, as of 2005 when this was made, they put an Aboriginal people's warning up front, right? Or indigenous people, maybe?
Man, that's what I'm saying. Like
shit, now I can't.
You know how Eskimo is? It turns out that's like a terrible slur. That's not
say Inuit. Sure.
Well... I get, yeah. So I'm trying to educate because, you know, turns on us white people came to this continent and just started naming names and not paying attention to what people called themselves. And it turns out that after, you know, in the 21st century, they're like, you know, actually never been cool with you guys just picking names out for us. And actually that's super offensive word. And so, try to be sensitive where you can be.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, with that said, kind of. We have a similar history with Australia in that regard, right?
Right, but it's not the same. And
certainly.
Also, and that's why I get this vague awareness that there was, even some shockingly terrible things happening even as late as, like, the 70s in Australia.
Yeah.
Maybe even they're still, like, I don't know where in the stream of time they are at this. But my point was there was a lot of fascinating interactions between the Aborigines that were working with the Australians.
The Uncle Toms.
Like, when he was interrogating that group of Aborigines and they all started howling and kind of, like, that was kind of taking the piss at the captain.
Yeah.
But his guide kind of joined in as if he was like, you know, kind of fuck you. But he's also hunting down his fellow people, and when the gangster Aborigine caught up with them, clearly was incensed and offended and singled him out for special killing.
Yeah.
So it's like there's a lot of this hostility that I wasn't quite sure how to interpret. And like, how did they feel about that? And there again, that's where I felt like I only had half of the story going in, so I couldn't really fully appreciate those interactions.
Yeah, me
It'd
too.
Be like if you're from...
And also the baggage that comes with having a similar but not identical history in that regard.
Like imagine if you're from, like, I don't know, Indonesia, and you watch Django Unchained. Do you, and like, and you're, Jesus. You've never read a history book on American history. Do you, what do you make of,
you
know,
no idea.
Django's dealings with, was it Stephen who was the, what does that mean when he's a black slave driver and the Mandingo fighting and the candy ranch and being like, does that, you can appreciate it as the human drama it is, but all the backstory that we just know, we understand, like, this is a bad deal and this is why it is. Like, you would miss a lot of that.
Sure.
I don't, that's why.
Yeah,
I
can't even imagine.
And that's what I'm saying. Like, that's how I feel watching mm-hmm. some of these things. Because especially anytime you see a movie, that's like, there's a warning. If you're a part of these people, this could be highly offensive, and this is some sensitive history.
Yeah,
you know, that's like, that should be clue number one. That whoa.
But also, like I was saying, you know,
the powder keg,
the similar history that we have in that regard can trick you into thinking that maybe you have a good grasp on
right.
it, when in fact you're way off.
Yes,
and they're not the same in any kind of
yes.
way.
Yes, yes.
But on the surface, they appear very similar.
Yeah, like, you know, it's, you want to make everything analogy to Little Bighorn or whatever.
Exactly.
No, that's super offensive to even think that way. So yeah.
Yeah.
But. Yeah, I wish
I'm uneasy about that stuff. But.
And I did, like, I read like an hour's worth of Australian history, you know, on Wikipedia and other sites, and I still feel like I haven't scratched the surface. It'd be like, you know, if you wanted to understand colonization of the United States.
Yeah, you do an hour of research of a 100-year period.
Yeah, right. And, like, you know, I'm also fascinated, like, I think of the Aborigines as like one mass of people. Like,
yeah.
You would think of, like, maybe a person reading with Native Americans, but you're talking about different nations, man.
Yeah.
With different cultures, and you can't just say, like, well, because you know the Cherokee, then you know the Seminole, and you know the Hopi, and then also talk about different times, like the Aztec, and I wonder if there's a lot of that where it's like I haven't even scratched the surface of how complex it is.
Sure. There's probably a lot more than we're realizing here, as far as commentary, as far as the intricacies of the morality involved. There's a lot of stuff there. And then you got guys like John Hurt in this film, right?
Oh, Jesus.
Who are these old, drunken racists who have no shame.
Right.
Have no remorse about this stuff. And
right.
are just out there doing bad things.
Yeah, because that's when we're talking about trying to decide if people are good or bad, you also, once you decide, like, okay, by modern standards, is this person good or bad?
Yeah.
Because that's what the filmmakers are going for. Then you start thinking about, okay, in standards of their time,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you can get into situations like you're watching The Nick and you're like, all these people are assholes.
Yeah,
the hero, he's a fucking racist. Why do I feel good about anything? And you're like, okay, maybe he's progressive for the time. Then I'm completely unequipped, except for to say that John Hurt's Bounty Hunter is a piece of shit no matter what century he's in.
Oh, yeah, totally.
Very colorful and memorable.
Fascinating. Like, I love watching this guy act.
Yeah.
He's amazing. And I was hoping... So in my notes, I have written down John Hurt, the old drunken racist. This should be an interesting journey, but it wasn't. It wasn't an interesting journey. Like, they didn't end up using him very much at all.
No,
he gets killed.
At the end, he's kind of killed without much effect.
Yeah. So I was surprised that they didn't use him more. But honestly, they didn't really need it. Like, we should talk
about
the acting.
It's always interesting though to see like really well educated people, but they're educated on bullshit. Like, there's a plot right now at The Nick where these people are talking about. These very rich and
like
well-educated white people are talking about
Django.
Eugenics.
Yes.
And how great it's going to be when we can, like, you know, just sterilize all the undesirable people. And it's just, like, horrifying. But
it is, yeah.
They've spent a lot of time educating themselves on junk science with horrific implications. And I always think that's fascinating.
And it shows you, like, progress, right?
The
scientific and cultural progress that we're continuing to build.
Yeah.
And at the time, those things are probably considered cutting-edge, quote-unquote, science, but...
Sure.
Like a phrenologist is some kind of educated person, whereas today we laugh at that shit.
Sure. And it makes you wonder, like, what are we doing right now that 100 years from now people are going to be like, oh boy, these rubes, you know?
Yeah.
What is that going
to
be?
It'll all have to do with the names of our sports teams. can we talk about the acting?
Sure. Like, I want to read. Let's read another paragraph out of the pre-back that Tim gave us. He said, "As far as the cast, I thought the Winstone and Pierce were both excellent as usual. As was Emily Watson. Faramir was convincingly smarmy as Mr. Fletcher. John Hurt as Jelen Lamb, the racist piece of shit bounty hunter we were just talking about, stole the movie during his brief scenes. Frankly, I've never been overly impressed with Danny Houston, but he nails the role of Arthur. I found him to be every bit as strange and disturbing as Ben Mendelsohn in Animal Kingdom, to which I say, nay, Tim. Nay.
Nay. You like Mendelsohn more?
I think Danny Houston, and this might be controversial, but for me, I thought he was at replacement level acting. Like, there's any one of a half dozen character actors who could have done the job that he did.
So he doesn't have a huge part.
Well, I'm thinking, like, you know, man, I'm terrible with names. I'm so terrible with names. Who played Commissioner Gordon in Dracula? Gary Oldman.
He played Commissioner Gordon in Dracula?
Yes, Gary Oldman. Gary Oldman would have been a better fit, probably, for this role. Or I'm thinking of like a lot of different...
better fit. I mean, I don't think that Houston did a bad job.
No. I thought he was good. That's what I'm saying. He's right at replacement level. Like, okay. He didn't detract from the movie, but I don't think he elevated the material like
some
people
would. He didn't define
the
role maybe like you would want him to?
No, whereas Ben Mendelsohn in Animal Kingdom,
yeah,
his exact brand of kind of unhinged suburban gangster, I can't imagine many other people doing that performance, let alone doing it better.
Yeah, I'm with you. I actually saw, like, I read several reviews on this, and almost every single one just said how good Houston was and almost left Winstone completely out of it.
I'm like, man,
Winstone makes this movie.
Is it Winston or Winstone?
It's spelled Winstone. I don't know if it's Winstone or Winston, whatever. So the guy playing Stanley.
The guy,
right?
From Sexy Beast.
Sure. I've never seen that, but I know he's in it.
Mm-hmm.
He, to me, makes this movie. I think without Guy Pearce and without him, it's nowhere near as good as it is.
Agreed. And I can't... Guy Pearce, I've enjoyed his acting a lot, and it's, we had this conversation because I feel like Guy Pearce and Christian Bale work in a very similar vein. And I've wondered, like, what if the time machine was as big a vehicle for him, for Guy Pearce, as, like, Batman was for Christian Bale? Because, you know, Christian Bale did a lot of independent stuff, and he did American Psycho, and he did, you know... he was in that Dragonfire or whatever the fucking, you know.
Oh, Reign of Fire.
Yeah. And he's been a lot of stuff. And he started off with, like, what, Empire of the Sun? Like, I was a child actor. He did a lot of stuff, and he did Batman, and then he's, like, in everything.
Yeah.
I wonder if, like, the reason Guy Pearce never got to that second stage level is because his big star vehicle just flopped.
I suppose it could be. Because he's really just an excellent actor.
And in this
movie, the more I've seen of him, the more I like him.
This movie, he's just cadaverous. Like, he's just a wreck of a human being. Like, Guy Pearce is a very handsome man, and he's playing with, like, wood teeth.
Yeah.
He's skeletal. Mm-hmm. He's got maggots coming out of body holes a couple of occasions in this movie. It's just really very similar to the way that, like, Val Kilmer approached the role of Doc Holliday in Tombstone. Like, this is just a human ruin. He's a Hulk. Not in the incredible way, just like a dismasted, sinking ship kind of way.
Huh.
He's just, and Christian Bale does that to himself a lot. Like, think of him in The Machinist.
Oh, yeah.
Where it's just like your jaw drops in some of these scenes where you see him.
Or what was that boxing movie that Mickey Ward...
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Was it The Fighter?
Something like, they all have generic names. Yeah. Who knows? But
The Puncher.
What he does to his body for that thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oof.
So I feel like Guy Pearce did an outstanding job of this thinking, haunting criminal.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I just don't understand why. I don't understand his motivations when it comes to his family and his brother and his gang and what he feels as far as loyalty towards that. And what does he do? What does he do after this movie?
I don't know. I mean, I could look it up.
Yeah, I was gonna say, to the extent that he's a real human person, it'd be interesting. But, like,
oh, what does Guy Pearce do, or what does Charlie Bunz do?
What's Charlie Bunz
do? Oh, I don't know. He goes back into the wilderness because he's still an outlaw, I guess.
And it's beautiful out there.
Yeah, it's beautiful in this bleak desert type of way. Sure. Yeah,
like in an almost like this is the landscape that your brain takes when you're on a inspirational acid trip.
Okay. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
You've just swallowed a whole thing of ayahuasca.
Yeah,
and
exactly. Exactly. You're going on a spirit journey.
Vision quest.
Yep. You're gonna meet a coyote voiced by Johnny Cash, and he's gonna tell you how to resist the chili pepper of madness. That's what you go
and
to.
And you got Gary Busey next to you.
Say, do you think we're gonna freeze to death?
Good stuff. So that's the other thing too, right? Talking about this landscape. Like, And Stanley is kind of almost manic, kind of crazed way that he refuses to let this wilderness beat him, and he wants to civilize this land. Mm. He constantly goes on about that, and you can see, like, that's kind of reflected in the way that his wife is preparing the garden, played by Emma Watson, who is also equally
and
awesome.
She gets a fresh Christmas tree delivered to the middle of the outback, which is kind of, it feels miraculous.
This but garden also, does not. This garden feels like
it's sad.
Futility.
Yeah, no.
The highest degree of futility.
But I feel like it's all intentional, right? Like, you're supposed to see that as, like, absurd, and you're supposed to see the Christmas tree as absurd. And then the fact that the climax happens on Christmas Day is, like, a perversion of the holiday. Like, she's in this denial, and she's wanting this, you know, very particular way of life to be restored or brought to this place.
And it's the landscape and what you said about Christmas being the day that all this shit goes down.
Yeah.
That really shows you the magnitude of the task, right? Like, if you're going to civilize this land, you got a long road ahead of you.
Yeah, sure.
Because there is nothing sacred here, and the land doesn't give a shit, and the indigenous peoples don't give a shit.
Yeah.
They're not here for your to serve you.
No.
So good luck, buddy.
Yeah.
And I think that's illustrated both in the visuals and also in the plot itself, yeah.
So he also, Tim Double T here asks, what did you make of the unusual soundtrack by Nick Cave, who also wrote the film? I loved it, thought it was created an effectively surreal atmosphere. The opening of this film where they're playing that Happy Days.
Oh, God, it's horrible.
And the worst. Way the music is composed, like, it's some kind of like somewhere between a harpsichord and a bagpipe that's been shot by a 45. It is creepy.
Accordion with a hole in the thing.
It is unsettling, and it added to that kind of weird film, you know, kind of slightly lost quality to this film.
Yeah, the theme song over the credits is truly terrible. I can hardly stand to even listen to it. The other thing is I'm not certain how much of this is like they mix cast photos in with what I think are real photos. So you said like earlier, is this outrage thing like part of real history? I don't know, because there are some shots of like dead people, which I assume are actual real shots.
Sure.
And there's a scene that they mimic in the plot of the movie where a dead guy is hung up in front of a door so they can take his photo. For his death picture, I guess.
Yeah, it was weird.
Because they used to do that type of shit. That was a thing. So I'm not sure if that's a real thing or not, given the strange nature of the credits.
I want to read this brief biography that I found from Nick Cave. Says he's an Australian musician, songwriter, author, screenwriter, composer, and occasional film actor. He's best known as the frontman of Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. Mm-hmm. A group known for its diverse output and ever-evolving lineup. Prior to that, he fronted The Birthday Party, one of the most extreme and confrontational post-punk bands of the early 80s. Referred to as rock music's Prince of Darkness, Cave's music is generally characterized by emotional intensity, a wide variety of influences, and lyrical obsessions with death, religion, love, and violence. NME, whatever that is, magazine described him as the Grand Lord of Gothic Lushness. That sounds like the guy who wrote and composed the music for this film.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you've heard of this guy before?
Sure, yeah. There's a song.
Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds?
Yeah, they wrote a song, the Red Right Hand song, like the tall, handsome man in a dusty black coat with his red right hand.
Mm.
That song. I used it in the last season of True Detective.
Oh, yeah.
I think the last episode of True
Detective. Okay, now I remember you saying that, and I was intent on watching the film, so I didn't attend to what you were saying.
Yeah, that song is fairly popular. It was a fairly big hit. But I didn't know he was a writer.
Like, it'd be so weird to be like finding like David Bowie was a writer and a director.
Yeah,
and you know, or I guess this would be more of like Ozzy Osbourne.
Okay.
The way they write about him sounds more like an Ozzy Osbourne. Like Ozzy Osbourne also
the Prince
wrote,
of Darkness, sure.
Also wrote, if you find out he wrote Unforgiven and scored the movie, it'd be like, what? That's how I'm feeling about finding this out. I find it super fascinating.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's a really gruesome whipping.
Yeah.
And I thought what was shocking is they only got to like, 39 lashes out of a 100 lash sentence before it was called off by just everyone being being sickened by the brutality, which that kind of rung false to me.
Okay.
Like, I don't think the people in the 1890s or whenever, that's when this film was set, right?
1870s. Yeah.
With this kind of provocation, I don't know that people get sickened by that violence at 30. I don't, it feels like that they'd be crying for blood.
They'd be cheering the fact
that town folk, like, nobody would get disgusted about, like, you know, maybe the guy gets tired and they have to bring in a new guy to do the flogging, have to rotate him in and out, but
yeah,
it seemed like a pitiless crowd. And that's the other thing where it's like, maybe, again, I don't understand the Australian psyche, but that felt false to me, that people, the same people that were screaming for this punishment to happen would be turned off by the fact that the guy essentially screamed and then passed out.
The realities of the punishment. Yeah. I'm not sure how I feel about that.
And then I started, because, you know, I'm also, I happen to be rereading the Patrick O'Brien nautical fiction, and it shouldn't be any surprise that the flogging is fairly common in the books. You know, it's a routine form of naval punishment. But I did a lot, because I thought, like, a 100-lash sentence was pretty much a death sentence. Like, you were not
supposed...
Sounds
like it, yeah.
You're not supposed to live through that. But apparently, I guess the maximum naval punishment that was allowed in, like, the Nelson era, which is, like, in the, you know, early 17th century, like, 1790 to, like, 1820, was 1,200 lashes.
12? Why? What's the point of that, even?
Well, I guess...
After 900, what else is left to lash?
But that's the thing, like, I don't know whether they're confusing what a cat of nine tails actually does, because... A cat of nine tails is just essentially string that was tied in knots. It wasn't like the stuff
fragments
they always talk with,
or anything. Up,
yeah, like
top.
Jesus was flogged with, like, yeah, bits of metal and nails and shit. But yeah, and, like, they had this punishment called flogged around the fleet, where you would get several boats would come up, and you would get flogged 100 lashes on one ship. They'd row you to another ship, lash you up and give you another 100, and you'd do that for every ship that happened to be at the fleet.
Are they spreading the fun around? Like, what's...
I don't
what's
know.
What's the point of that? As a demonstration? Like,
and it was like something like, you know, like...
Don't
like
that, fuck up.
They did that stuff for, I don't know, like striking an officer. Like, mutiny, yeah, yeah. They just hang you from the yardarms and you'd be dead. But this is like kind of like, look at what this guy did, and all of you should do. It's like very much an example.
Okay.
An humiliation thing.
That makes sense.
But I also was like, there was interesting, like, that I guess that they, at least in naval tradition, they made a new cat of nine tails for each punishment. And for 24 hours before the prisoner was to be flogged, it was his job to make his cat.
Oh, God. It's like, and digging your own grave.
Well, no, I'm sorry. Like, I always thought, it's like, where did the fucked up tradition of, like, I've just heard of, like, this is my parents always told me when they were whipping me.
Yeah.
When I was growing up, your grandfather made me go out to the tree and get my own switch. And I'd bring it back to him. And if it was too small, he'd make me go out and get a bigger one. Or he would go pick out a bigger one and beat me with it. And, you know, it's like, that's fucked up. Like, making a child go and get his own punishment and then knowing that, well, I got to get one. This one might kill me, but this one won't hurt enough. But I guess that was the thing. Like, you had to make it and then... Like, if the bosun's mate came in and judged your cat of inferior quality, they'd build a worse one and you get more strokes. And it's like,
wow,
man, maybe all this, like, parental... Like, maybe we can blame the Napoleonic War for the fucked up child punishment practices that we got in the 20th century. Like,
sure.
After it passed, you know, it's like, my great-great-grandfather was a sailor, and then that started the insanity. It was all about rum and and sodomy in the lash.
Sure.
Pick two.
I don't really have a ton more to say about this film. I thought it was excellent, though.
Yeah, all the flogging talk took it out of me, I guess.
Yeah. Does the commissioner have anything to say about it? Not the commissioner.
Two-time commissioner, though. Nothing to sneeze at.
Yeah.
So what do you guys think of this as a Western? How does it compare to an American Western? How does the land compare to that of the Old West? I have thought it shown as more stripped back, basic, and brutal. Yeah, essentially. Yeah.
Like, the landscape to me felt more harsh.
Australia,
honestly.
The country, like, you know, it feels like a continent that has to be endured.
Yeah, something that's actively trying to kill you at all times.
Yeah, like, I don't know. That's I wonder what... How do Australians feel about their land? Like, you know, in America, it's all amber waves of grain and purple mountain majesties, and this land's your land's land. Yeah, it's a very, very Pollyanna, Americana kind of, you know, very huggy-feely relationship. Mm-hmm. And the places we have that are brutal, we don't live there. We just, like, make postcards out of and have Ansel Adams go out there and take pictures.
Go there to gamble.
Sure. But, like, I feel like, I wonder, like, how does Australians feel about their country that's always trying to kill them?
I don't know.
With firestorms and... Mm-hmm.
Animals that just want to kill you.
Yeah, poisonous koalas and man-eating sharks. Okay. And I feel like the Great Barrier Reef is trying to literally encircle and destroy Australia. How does that feel? Because... That's the one big difference, is I thought that I saw bleak, brutal landscapes in many, many Westerns, but this thing takes the cake.
Yeah.
Like everyone that's out in this outback, this range, they look like beef jerky.
Yeah.
They look like people with they're made of beef jerky and wooden teeth.
Most of all, John Hurt. He just...
I think that, like, Guy Pearce is right there with them. I mean...
It's true, yeah.
They're all just wind-beat, sun... dried raisin people. It's crazy. And also, like, again, yeah, like, I don't feel like I have a really good handle on your all's relationship historically with the native people and outlaws, and that made it very, you know, when I see the OK Corral depicted, I kind of know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are.
Yeah.
And when it's just really made me realize how provincial I am, because I went into kind of that situation and I was like, I have completely lost here. He also says, I think Jim mentioned once the impression he had of us Aussie movies were of cliche-ridden oddball films with over-the-top characters.
Yeah.
He's right that there are plenty of those. They're the ones that are more likely to make a splash overseas. We probably have Crocodile Dundee to thank for that. And Yahoo Serious. He did a lot of damage, too.
I haven't seen... I don't know what that is.
I remember when he came out, it was supposed to be the next... He was supposed to be the next Crocodile Dundee. Oh, God. I'm like, oh, man, I don't know about that.
That's a mistake right off the bat.
However, there are quite a few of these kinds of high-quality psychodramas that can also be found. I hope you guys enjoyed it.
Yeah, after the two that he's introduced us to, Animal Kingdom and this, I have a larger appreciation for Australian cinema.
Sure.
I don't now see it just as quirky, oddball characters in kind of a mishmash of a horrible landscape.
I thought it was an amazing experience of a film, and I didn't probably get half of the nuances to the plot, but as an experience of just this brutal justice being dispensed and this fight for civilization and what is civilization and what are we losing in that fight, I thought it was pretty remarkable, and it worked regardless of how clued in I was to the history of it.
I wonder if there are any Australian video games that depict this. Like, kind of like a like Red Dead Redemption.
You're talking
for
about
Australia?
The pornographic Atari 2600 no. Custard's Revenge?
No.
Where you go with a little 4-bit penis and rape an Indian woman at the end?
No, like a Red Dead Redemption for Australia sort of thing.
I don't know.
I've never heard of any, but I would be interested in playing one. Because, like, half the time when I'm watching these movies, I'm thinking... You know, it's a terrible existence, but it's also a much simpler time. Like, it's not like you've got to... There are, like, two major concerns, right? What am I going to eat, and who's trying to kill me?
Sure.
So, like, if those are your only concerns in life, it's pretty simple.
No, it's free in the way that, like, I feel like the same appeals about sailing. Like, you know...
Exactly. And I wouldn't want to live there.
Yeah, nowadays
you can't do that. But I'm interested in experiencing... Maybe getting a lens into what that felt like. You know?
Like, I mean, nowadays there's no Badlands where you can go out and just get away from the law.
No, period.
Just do whatever the hell you want to do.
I mean, you got to maybe go into the Amazon and try and
that's true.
Get away that way, hide in the dense forest. I don't know.
But most of the places you're born, you get a social security number and a government ID, and then you're signed up for a bunch of lists, and that's your life.
And that has its advantages. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
Huge advantage.
For example, I don't look like a piece of human beef jerky with wooden teeth.
Well, sure. That's true.
Despite the U.S. Insurance and health system, I still have reasonably healthy teeth and skin.
Yeah. I don't know. I wish there was a way to kind of get an idea of what it felt like to live there other than just through film. We need an Australian Outback game.
Well, you need to freeze yourself and wait about another 150, 200 years and get in on the Martian colonization.
Yes.
Space cowboys and space pirates, baby. Mark Watney was just the first ninja pirate from outer space. He won't be the last.
I love it. That's what I'll have to do.
Double T. Tim, thank you for commissioning this podcast. We enjoyed watching it and talking about it quite a bit. If you'd like to commission your podcast, it's pretty easy. Go to baldmove.com/shop and pick out. There's some pre-selected ones from our club members that you can get shares of for as low as $10. And, you know, you get some of your friends together. You can group commission a podcast. And you also can just do one a la carte.
Yeah, the pickings are getting slim over there.
Yeah, well, it's about time to reshuffle that deck.
I think so.
We got, you know, we've been very fruitful. We got the Firefly and the Princess Bride. Oh,
Princess Bride.
And what, Pulp Fiction is another one. We got some good ones. It's time to put some fresh blood to that. The Shining, yep.
Yeah.
So yeah, baldmove.com/shop if you want to commission your podcast. Again, Double T from Melbourne. Thanks for introducing us to the cinema from your country, your fine country.
Yeah.
I'm hungry for more.
Me too. Maybe we'll get some more Australian commissions here in the future. But until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. See ya.